Hello and welcome to the Lightfoot Podcast. This week, Scout Leader Wiley and I discuss the psychological perks and deep healing possibilities of cultivating a practice of ritual art. We unpack what it means to foster an arcane intellect and delve into the hot topics of gender and race identity, exploring Scout's broader philosophical framing in the process. I enjoyed this conversation immensely and hope you do too. So without further ado, I bring you Scout Leader Wiley. Scout, welcome to the Lightfoot Podcast. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. It's really lovely to be here. I'm very excited. I have no idea where this is going to go or how it's going to go, and that's kind of my favorite. So let's do it.
Awesome. Well, the first place I want to go with you is I want to hear a bit more about the Arcane Intellect Project.
Sure.
What is it? How did it come to be? And what does it mean to have or cultivate an arcane intellect?
Yeah, I really like that question. So this kind of emerged out of a personal sort of, shall we say, conflict I was having between two parts of myself. One of them, this very rational, empiricist sort of part that is really only satisfied with answers that make sense, with answers that can be proven, and doesn't want to accept anything beyond that. And this part of me that really yearns for a mythology of reality, like a cohesive narrative, a way to make sense of things that feels good and that gives me a sense of aliveness. And I'd often found that the two were sort of having trouble connecting with each other. And so the Arcane Intellect Project is sort of born of this realization that this is a common conflict. This is actually this is more of a cultural conflict between sense-making on the one hand of learning about what's true objectively and what does objectivity actually even really mean, and does objectivity render our subjective experiences meaningless, or can they be reconciled? And so I guess the sort of inquiry that's at the core of that project is how do I and how do we collectively recontextualize our symbolic narratives, our sort of our sense of wonder at things that we don't fully understand, without becoming ungrounded, without sort of dismissing the way that people refer to it as science denial. So how do we not deny scientific truths and still be able to interact with the world through the lens of something like astrology, or through the lens of something like hermetic alchemy, or through Wiccan paganism, or shamanic practices? Because ultimately there are rational explanations for a lot of the subjective phenomenon that we experience. We might not always know what they are, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. And then on the other hand, just because we can't explain these things yet doesn't mean that they aren't actually happening, or that they aren't valid, or that they aren't important ways of getting to, at the very least, personal truths. And if we want to get super hopeful, or super if we want to stretch it, we might be able to access some objective truths through that as well. So I hope that it kind of answers your question. Let me know if I need to explain anything.
Oh, it does. It's fascinating. Yeah, it feels like one of the most rich and important inquiries we can make, of how to kind of weave together those different parts. I mean, you could kind of look at that as different hemispheres of the brain. That's kind of how Ian McGilchrist frames it. There's lots of different ways to kind of break that down. Rational animism is one way that it's been described to me lately, and I kind of like that framing. So did you come more from an arcane or intellectual side and then kind of balance the other out, or have they always both been kind of big parts of you?
It's funny because one of the sort of frameworks that I like to look at things through is the lens of spiral dynamics, which is essentially, I think you're probably familiar with it, but just to explain in case there are listeners that maybe aren't, to give some context, it's a sort of a developmental theory of how values evolve based on how the environment around us changes. And it's based on Claire Graves's sociological work. It's very fascinating. There are so many different versions of it. And through that lens, there's this sort of linear process that you notice in the development of our values and the way that we interact with reality, where we kind of go through this pre-rational phase where we have these experiences, and the narrative and the symbolic imaginal sort of way of interpreting things is the most real way of experiencing reality. Once we start to develop a rational view of the world, so we start to develop our critical thinking, it's kind of like we tear that down, and we in the process of criticizing these experiences through the rational lens, we kind of end up maybe dismissing, for the most part, any of the way that we might have been experiencing things. So to give a more specific example, in my personal experience, I have, I suppose, started with interpreting things through a mostly imaginal lens and sort of falling into what they call the pre-post fallacy or the pre-trans fallacy, which is essentially elevating all non-rational experiences to being more true than rational experiences. And then after developing a sense of a critical thinking on a deeper level, which you could call, I guess, the intellectual side of the arcane intellect idea, you go through this thing where you sort of dismiss these things as not real. So I've had experiences that you could call like either a spiritual awakening or a psychotic breakdown, depending on who you ask. And I like to think that it was both. But so I did kind of start off with this very, shall we say, sort of woo perspective on the world, which I then had to deconstruct. And I realized that neither the deconstructing aspect or the pre-rational aspect were the full answer. Neither of them were untrue, but neither of them were an absolute full universal truth in and of themselves. But they both provided a different perspective on the same thing. That's when you sort of start getting into the what they would call transrational, which is allowing this sort of rational and the pre-rational to inform then a meta perspective on that incorporates both of them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. So where do you feel that you're at in that process right now?
Right now, I'm I'm sort of in that, shall we say that like metamodern cavern of kind of figuring out what it means, and not really having the words for it yet, but sort of going through the process of seeing it and recognizing it where it shows up and then finding a way to sort of share that with the world. So that does kind of maybe sound like on the surface, I have no idea what I'm doing. And that's true. But I also think that it's weirdly not knowing what I'm doing is intentional in that way. I'm kind of like trying to have the most blank slate in my mind that I possibly can as I look at different scientific understandings, like natural scientific understandings of reality, and juxtaposing those with origin stories and mythologies of how reality works. And so to give a more specific example, what that might look like is looking at the threads between like neurobiological truths, like how we process information, and then how we sort of have the stories that we've told ourselves about the nature of God or the nature of life, or the stories of sort of non-existent characters, so to speak, like Finn McCool or someone like that, But I don't know if I should explain who Finn McCool is. Finn McCool is like a hero character in Irish mythology. It's very interesting. There are some similarities between his story and the story of Jesus Christ. Perhaps that's for another time. So looking at these sort of stories, like the story of Finn McCool or the story of Jesus Christ or Aesop's fables or what have you, and looking at those and juxtaposing the sort of metaphors that you see in those with what's actually empirically, physically true about reality and then how we experience it. Sort of trying to bridge the gap between these worlds, if that makes sense. And it's a very murky place because I don't really think it's been done before, or it's been attempted, but it has not really been solidified in quite the way that I'm imagining it, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's been a kind of overarching project of the last few decades, isn't it? You kind of see it, science and spirit. There's some kind of like new age quantum physical union, which some people feel that, you know, the two are really meeting each other that way. I mean, that has its cheesier, cornier versions, but also there's people a lot smarter than me that seem to really understand those correlations and find solace in that, which is quite beautiful. But I wonder for you, if there's a scientist and a magician inside of you, how integrated is that? Because do you oscillate between the two, or have you found a kind of unified synthesis? And yeah, what does that feel like? Is there tension there? Does it feel settled, or does it feel kind of an uneasy union?
It's definitely all of those things. So it's really contextual, and I love this question. It's very challenging, and I appreciate it. I appreciate that. I would say that it's kind of a mixture of all of those things that you mentioned. So there are certain contexts in which I can feel the sort of scientific part of me is more at play. And then there are places where the magical part of me is more at play, and then there are places where they interact. And this is a really good bridge to talking about the concept of ritual art. Because the ritual art process is essentially the meeting place of the two. So I'll go into what I think I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about places where the sort of science me comes out more, and then the places where the magic me comes out more. And then I'll talk about ritual art, which is effectively the place where they come together and the process of bringing them together as well.
Awesome.
So I notice, and this is really funny to me, just as like, an observation of myself, and I'm sure that this is common. I have this habit of when someone is very fixed upon a narrative they have about reality, a story they have about reality, something they believe to be true, that is when I start to be more challenging. And I sort of get into the process of critical thinking, of asking for evidence, of examining the logic and possible flaws in the logic. It's so much easier to engage that part of me when it's someone else. When it's me, when I'm observing myself, I tend to go more into the magical narrative. I tend to go more into to representing things symbolically or mythologically in my understanding of and relationship to myself. So I'm curious what it would be like to sort of switch those, to sort of have myself have the intellectual scrutiny towards myself, which is something that I'm starting to practice more, but I'm not incredibly skilled at it, but it is something that I've noticed is useful in certain contexts. And then to sort of mythologize others, that's something that I can do, but I try to limit doing, because you don't want to invalidate someone else's concept of themselves necessarily and say that your narrative is more true than theirs, but it might be interesting to then compare narratives. And this is something that I learned in authentic relating, is like comparing your experience of the person with their experience of themselves is a way to sort of hold accountable and also give the benefit of the doubt. So it's like, oh, I'm experiencing you in this way. And the other person's like, oh, well, I don't experience myself like that, but like, I can understand why you would experience me in that way. And then we can move from there. Nobody's experience is invalidated, but nobody's experience is considered like the true experience, if that makes sense. So that's something that I think sort of gets at what you're talking about there. In terms of the ritual art practice. So the ritual art practice is the process of examining the self that the conscious mind is not really necessarily aware of or skilled at listening to. It's sort of like a combination of hypnosis and what Anton LaVey, the founder of LaVey and Satanism, would describe as psychodramatic catharsis, which I'll get into what that is in a second. But to give an example of what ritual art is, it is a practice, I would say, of sort of a creative, one creates a creative container in which one can express without any sort of structure or judgment or expectation. It's just a creative flow. Once that container is sort of sealed and is completed, a process of analysis then ensues. So it's a sort of like engaging the pre-rational, allowing the pre-rational to expose itself, and the sort of containment, the ritual sealing of the container kind of will communicate to the more unconscious parts of you that they're allowed to express, that they're not going to be criticized or expected to change. And this will sort of call them forth, if that makes sense. After this, one can kind of take a look at what came out and use their analytical intelligence that's to maybe create some deeper meaning there. So I guess dream analysis, we talked a little bit about dreams before we got on the call, and dream analysis, I would say, is pretty close to ritual art. I would say the main difference is that what ritual art is that it's what artists do. It's you can write in this process, you can dance in this process, and maybe videotape yourself and then look at it and try to analyze, what does this movement here mean? What am I seeking to express here? So it's like a process of understanding elements of the self that can only really come out when you're not thinking about it. I don't know.
How is it specific been enough, beneficial to you? Has it been a kind of important practice that you've been using yourself?
Yeah, I actually am not the only person who does practices like this. I would say that the inspiration for it comes from the community that I've been a part, like the artistic community that I've been a part of for, I guess, almost 5 years now, in Bushwick, Brooklyn, the sort of DIY music community. So the essence of that is, rather than having the traditional way of going to see music, where it's incredibly expensive and it's usually only bands that can afford to like promote themselves in a specific way, there's a community centered around throwing one's own sort of show. So you have this sort of house show culture that is really super prominent there, and it's cool. And it's picked up a lot now that a lot of the COVID restrictions have been lifted and whatnot. It's really thriving, despite the fact that, you know, despite all of the like rent changes and things that happen in New York, and New York is changing a lot. The culture seems to really be going strong. So that's really nice. But the essence of that culture is to kind of come together and experiment consistently artistically. There's a lot of chaos that comes with a sort of unofficial, nobody's really in charge, but there are people who are in positions of leadership, the people who open their personal homes to allow artists to come in and be a part of a show, the people who provide the equipment, people who run the door. It's this very collaborative, communal, anarchic sort of structure there. And what I've sort of been in that space, and I've also sort of analyzed how being in that space has affected me philosophically and in terms of my individuation process. And what I've come to realize is that through sort of collaborative, creative containers that are open to experimentation, the learning process and the evolutionary process that emerges from that is very unique. And I didn't really notice how unique it was until I left. And I was like, oh, this is a very unique thing that the DIY. And of course, in Bushwick, it's not the only DIY community. But there are a lot of DIY communities in like other cities and towns across America. But there's something very, very unique about the nature of that subculture. And this is kind of what gave birth to the concept of ritual art for me, is that two things that come together are the artistic process, which is ultimately the shamanic process. That's my my hypothesis, is that when you think about the shamanic arts, what's really going on is you're going into a trance state and then you're doing raw expression. And the expression comes out in a symbolic way. So that's also what art is. You sit down, you write a poem. It can be highly cryptic, or it can be highly, it can be referential to something that's super obvious. But there's still layers to it. There's the thing, and then there's what lies beyond the thing. And that's ultimately what shamanism is about. That's also what art is about. So I have it that they're ultimately the same thing. So you have this, and then you have a community centered around it. And then you have the process of analysis that takes place in trying to sort of sustain this intrinsically chaotic structure that is DIY subculture in music and art.
Beautiful. I know exactly what you're pointing to because of the experience I had with the community that I've been a part of the last 6 or 7 years, and really the creative pollination that would happen, particularly through open mics, which were essentially DIY parties because they were really festive. And there's something indescribable that I wish everyone on the planet was experiencing inside of that context, which is this fertility of your imagination and this cycle of bringing something new, offering it, and then having it received, and that orbit continuing to happen. And the development that I saw in myself and other people in that context was unparalleled. And there's a direct connection to, it's a spiritual sense, really, of something that transcends our usual waking experiences. It's sacred and it's holy, and it's profoundly beautiful. So I'm really glad to hear that you've experienced that, and that this has inspired you to then crystallize what that was and share that with others. So how are you taking people on that journey? If someone comes to you and says, all right, I'm ready for some ritual art, how are you kind of guiding them?
Oh, that's a really good, really good question. So the sort of guidance process for ritual art practice is, to me, it's sort of intuitive. So it's very interesting to sort of then lead others through it and try to explain it to people who don't have like the same background. And that's kind of what I'm working on now, is sort of getting to the heart of what really is this thing? Like, what does it entail? And it's because it's such an intuitive process, it'll look different to each person. But the backbone of the ritual art practice is essentially, what symbols call to you? Why do they call to you? How do you naturally express? Do you naturally express through sound, through movement, through visual? Like, what's your primary sort of sense? what's your primary way of processing information and presenting information? And then through that, you sort of commune with these different things that call to you, that may not make logical sense. And then we make logical sense of them as we discover them. So there's sort of a unveiling and unfolding that takes place that's sort of, I would say, hard to describe in a linear way. But except for in this sort of vague referential way where it's like, we'll see who you already are artistically and expressively, and we'll take that and we'll add elements of meditation and trance to it, and we'll add elements of analysis to it based on what resonates with the individual. Actually am considering possibly doing like a group project where I sort of don't work with people individually, and instead I just invite people to sort of explore the backbone of what a ritual art project or process is. And then from that, they can sort of take what they already are doing and turn it into something that's more structured.
Yeah, beautiful. I read one of your posts was a single line of poetry often contains more wisdom than the most detailed data-based logical analysis you can find. Rational thought is simultaneously undervalued and overrated. I like that idea. And it suggests that there's a lot of information encoded into art and ritual creations that often we don't see it that way. Are you familiar with Nora Bateson?
Loosely.
Yeah.
I've read a couple of her critiques of stage theory that I thought were pretty good.
Yeah, she's a wonderful thinker, and I often find that her poetry does that in such a beautiful way. There's a few kind of, I've been thinking of them as like systems poets. Bio Akomolafe is another one who I know you're familiar with. And yeah, it's really, really high art in my opinion, because it's there's a lot going on in there if you can kind of swim through it. And that's a beautiful thing. Is there a particular expression that you've been finding yourself? Is there a particular medium that has enabled you to kind of synthesize between the rational and magical parts of yourself?
Thank you. I'm glad you asked that. And I'm glad you brought up Bio Akomolafe, because I dare say he inspired that that post that you're referring to.
Okay.
Because he is really into political activism and the reconciliation of like indigenous wisdom with modern wisdom, with postmodern wisdom, and what that looks like as we construct this new thing from all of the things that all the tools that we have from the past, and it's going to form its own identity that is distinct from its parts. And he really gets to the heart of that strange sort of empty space that we're kind of finding ourselves in, which is why I was like, yeah, he can only do so through poetry, because it's not stable enough to then analyze yet. And so a lot of wisdom I find, or a lot of information I find, first has to come through in a non-rational way before rationality even has anything to work with, you know? So you can look at it as this sort of linear process. And yeah, I do like that you use the word oscillation, because there is an oscillatory nature to moving from pure pre-rational to transrational and back to pre-rational, in order to find new bits of information that might not really have a foundation yet. And language doesn't really officially I think I was trying to say officially and sufficiently, and then I came up with a new word by accident.
Nice. Yeah. I like it.
You can,
you oscillated.
I did.
You integrated. I love this idea of, I've just had a bit of a light bulb moment that I'm really glad about. Yeah. So I've been wrestling with this idea of wrestling, grappling, dancing, making out with neo-tribalism.
Yeah.
And it's exactly in that space. It's I try and write about it from all these different angles, and often it feels like it's, I'm happy with what I've created, but it's like, oh, I didn't get one, you know, 100th of the imaginal electricity that infuses me when I really sit with this idea. Mm. And yeah, I just think for people to remember that if you're, whatever you're most on the edge of thinking about, just come at it through art, through the symbolic world for quite a while, and you're going to progress in ways that you might not have realized. And it's, yeah, I can't believe that feels like a revelation to me when it, I feel like it should be such an obvious idea. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Cool. Beautiful.
You just did it. You just held space for me to become a more effective ritual artist.
I love that. I wasn't even trying.
Awesome.
Oh, you just became aware of think something that, or you found words for something that was already there. And that's kind of what we've been talking about, is the thing that we're wanting to refer to sometimes is like, we recognize it, we feel it, there's an intuitive sense of it, and then like the rational parts of us need more to work with,
yeah,
you know, before they can really do what it is that they're skilled at doing, which is separating the wheat from the chaff, kind of distinguishing what is subjective meaning making versus what is actually physically and perhaps metaphysically there. And they're both valuable, and but we need to contextualize them in order for them to be valuable, if that makes sense.
It does. And it reminds me broadly of just how undervalued the magical, artistic, arcane value system is in our culture. It seems like a fairly obvious point, but the fact that I will race at 2,000 miles an hour with my cognitive tools towards trying to figure something out, mm-hmm. and write about it and capture it, mm-hmm. without even pausing to think that's just one side of the story, that we're just so heavily weighted in that direction in our mm-hmm. culture. And yeah. It's a long journey we need to go on to rebalance those things, but such an important and critical one, you know. That's kind of like a meta narrative of everything that's unfolding, mm-hmm. and it's interesting that to catch it in myself as well, even those biases that are still operating. So yeah, that's useful.
Yeah, it's a very, very harrowing and uncomfortable practice, just kind of holding that and being like, I've noticed this in myself when I'm faced with an absolute, like if someone has an absolute truth or a narrative that they find to be more representative of the world than any other one, like on a grand scale, not even on an individual scale or on a particular discipline's scale, I think it's possible to have an absolute in regards to a particular perspective on reality. But mm-hmm. as far as the entirety of reality, when I'm faced with that, holding that sort of like not invalidating it, but also challenging it, but also seeing like, There's so much complexity to relating, I think, to a person's worldview in a way that is responsible, if the worldview is sort of calcified, if that makes sense. What you're kind of talking about with like our particular Western culture, and how it sort of values objectivity and progress and linearity so much that anything that it does not fit into that either gets restructured to fit into it, because we have such a deep unconscious belief that that's the best way to do it. So we'll take something that's non-linear, and then we'll be like, oh, there's a lot of wisdom there, but in order for it to be right, we have to make it linear. You know, spiral dynamics is a really good example of that. Something that's like, yeah, by the time you get to turquoise, you'll be God, as opposed to like seeing it as just an emergent system of values that is helpful in a certain context that has never existed before. But then there are other contexts that still exist where it might not really be the best system of values to impose on others, or it might be a good system of values to have in general, if one can operate in multiple contexts while still holding that one value system. But to impose a value system because it's superior to another value system, well, every value system has its upsides and downsides, and all of the upsides and downsides have to do with whether or not they're contextually effective. And that's not obviously the only reason, but that's a reason that I'm thinking of now and I'm fairly confident in.
Yeah. So in terms of your journey with that,
I
noticed I saw a post woke hashtag on one of your posts, and I saw some pretty interesting ideas that suggest that maybe you were a little deeper into that kind of worldview at one point. You mentioned at one point you were a they, them, and you even began transitioning and then went the other way. So would you talk to me a little bit about that journey? Is that, what does that look like? And how did you kind of move through that, I guess, to where you are now, or how you frame it yourself? I'm interested to hear.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things that people ask about the most when from me is like, well, what exactly was that experience for you? And it's interesting because at this stage, I'm curious about how I can responsibly talk about that while remaining honest about my perspective on the sort of this new emerging, or not this emerging, but like this sort of postmodern conception of gender and what it means and its value. And being honest about what I believe there without invalidating the experiences of people who disagree with me. And that's been tricky, and I've stepped on a lot of toes in the process of trying to figure that out. And I think I finally got into a space where I can be like, I can confidently say that gender, to use integral language, transcends and includes sex. It transcends and includes biology. It is not limited to biology. And my experience of sort of transitioning, I think, gave me some perspective on both the idea of fluidity with gender expression and the idea of binary gender expression. And so I have it that, to speak more specifically on my experience, like I was taking testosterone, I was going to get my breasts removed because I did not feel as though I fit neatly into the construct of what a woman should be. So I had a narrative that plugs into a larger cultural narrative. So it was a personal narrative that reflected a cultural narrative. And a belief structure about what it means to be a woman and what it means to be feminine, respectively. So both what it means to be a woman and what it means to be feminine, they were interacting with each other in my view of myself. And because there was such a mismatch there, I figured, and I also have like some, on a more biological level, I have issues with feeling my body physically in space. So there's never been, and I've basically was born like that. I don't remember a time when I could feel like physically there. I have like poor depth perception and all this stuff. So like that sort of tied into then this narrative I had about what it means to be a woman, and then this reflecting narrative of what it means to be feminine, and then this cultural narrative of that, and then this other cultural narrative of if you don't resonate with this, then that means you must be non-binary or transgender or something. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm that. Some people are. I don't believe that I am. I believe that that was a path to finding something that was more true for me and more true for a lot of people, which is that we construct these ideas of what gender means and should mean, related to but not limited to what our biological experiences are. And our biological experiences also change with time, with society's needs, all of that stuff. It's a really complex phenomenon that there are a lot of layers to, and there are a lot of elements to it. And I ended up oversimplifying it. And I think that a lot of people, whether they're cisgender or transgender, end up oversimplifying it for themselves because their default is that something about them needs to change in order to fit into the structure of what we've told ourselves gender means. Now, I have it now that the ideas that we have about what is feminine, a feminine gender role, are limited. So we've almost effectively cut ourselves off from the roots of where gender roles come from and how they've evolved through time and how diverse they've actually been, from like a multi-generational as well as a multicultural perspective. So when we think of like feminine gender roles in the Western modernist context, we think of, we have these two options. You can either be a feminist, and then there's a reductive way, like idea of what a feminist looks like, where it's like, if you're a feminist, then you like hate men and don't want kids, which is not true about feminists at all. But it's this sort of like overarching mainstream narrative that's kind of come into play that a lot of people do in fact embody. And it ends up getting more attention because it's so reductive and extremist. And then you have this conservative housewife who doesn't make any decisions and has long hair and wears makeup, even if she doesn't leave the house. And so there are these two extremes as far as like what it means to be a feminine person. And then you have, and then if you sort of like go beyond the scope of that, beyond the scope of that reductive traditional versus postmodern sort of idea of femininity and feminism, and you look at sort of cultural roles from like a more a broader perspective, you'll see incredible amount of diversity and evolution in regards to like how certain tribes and civilizations, what they believed men and women, and sometimes they had and often cases they had third, fourth, and fifth gender roles, where one could be like feminine, but didn't necessarily feel like disconnected from their body, which was biologically, so to speak, male. So they would feel fully connected to that body, but it would be if they believed that they had a feminine spirit or a female spirit. Mm-hmm. And that was seen as a gift. That was seen as a special, beautiful thing to have. And there was a place for people like that in society. And when you look at sort of the West now, there isn't a place. There isn't like a place where you, if you're beyond a binary, you have a particular role and value. It's like you're only valuable if you're within this binary construct. And it's starting to change, but it's not changing in a particularly authentic way, at least not in the mainstream. But I think it's a step in the right direction. I think that correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that that particular post was about the medicalization of the sort of non-binary experience and how it's like, if you want to transition, obviously, if that's like healthy for you, there's no judgment there from me. But there's judgment from a society that feels that that is a necessary prerequisite for being valid. And I think a lot of people choose it because they feel they have to. And that was my experience. I felt like I needed to change my body in order to be seen as something. And I still struggle with this, with like these constructs of femininity, especially since there's been like a traditionalist sort of revival in this. There's this, and I'm sure you're aware of this. So there's like a sort of conservative gender roles revival that's like come out as a backlash against there being more of a voice for third and beyond gender and sexuality that lies outside of the heteronormative experience. The traditional value structures sort of feel threatened by that in a lot of ways. And I think that it's perfectly fine to want to preserve that for yourself. If that's the value structure that is right for you. There's another thing to be said about imposing it on others. And I do see a lot of, and I know I've been talking for a while and I'll sort of wrap it up here because I would like to hear what your thoughts are on this. There is something to be said about the way that people are sort of engaging in these traditional gender roles right now, at least in my sort of sphere of the interwebs, which is that I really struggle to find nuance there. I really struggle to see where I fit there. And I don't consider myself outside of the binary, really. Not really. But I do consider myself to be, I don't consider myself to be in it either. I really struggle to see where someone who you would like.
So non-binary doesn't feel.
Doesn't, not anymore. Nothing really does. I mean, woman feels accessible to me only insofar as it describes my biological experience. It does not, the sort of implications of being a woman don't resonate. And that is because they're limited and they don't need to be that limited. They can be more expansive and they can still be connected to my biology while being expansive. And I don't think a lot of people realize that because it's highly complex and it's hard to really explain without being like, here's my personal experience of being a woman. And this experience doesn't invalidate being a woman just because it's not the idea of what a woman is or should be. And it matches a lot of, shall we say, like if we were less prone to historical erasure as a form of propaganda, we would see a lot of women like in the, there's a lot of erasure as far as like female philosophers goes. There's a lot of erasure as far as female warriors go. There's a lot of erasure as far as transgender women go in history. So we don't have an accurate idea of what it means to be a woman because we've destroyed all the evidence and that there's nuance to it. We've only sort of taken on this Puritan lens of what it means. And that really doesn't benefit anyone, in my opinion, whether you're, even if you are like a cis hetero woman, it still really doesn't benefit you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really rich, really interesting.
Yeah, I just talked for like a full half hour, so.
It's a good half hour, though. There's just so many layers of subtlety to it, isn't there? Mm-hmm. And it just reminds me of this kind of like being able to take on many different perspectives and being able to hold them all at once is really this kind of practice and art form that it's just, we've got to dedicate ourselves to because it sounds to me like there's a woman, a man, a non-binary person, and everything in between inside of you. And I feel something similar in myself. Mm-hmm. And they're really subtle shades that kind of layer in different moments on top of each other. Mm-hmm. While we're talking about completely uncontroversial modern day topics, how about race? Has that played into your experience? There was one post you've got here. My biggest pet peeve is being perceived as a race traitor. That's harsh. You ever feel like you've been perceived as a race traitor, I could imagine that would be a very uncomfortable experience.
Yeah, I sort of hate the concept of race traitordom for a couple of reasons. I think, for one, it implies that one sort of, in order to be considered, it's a very in-group, out-group rivalrous dynamic that's created out of thin air just by that phrase existing. And the implications of that are that in order to belong to a specific group, which is ultimately an arbitrary group that was created for the purposes of like class division and sort of preserving an incredibly imbalanced monetary structure, that's why it exists. It's become its own demon, obviously, and so it's a separate issue at this point, but it's also not separate from class issues in any way. They're very much intertwined, and what it kind of does is it adds this layer of separation to the experience of like being what we'll call like a lot of people will refer to Black and Brown people as a marginalized groups. And while I do understand the importance of acknowledging the historical marginalization that has literally taken place over like hundreds of years, I also think that it's important to create compelling parallel narratives to that. And I think that you're seeing a lot of that in social media. You have, I follow several accounts of people who, rather than talk about sort of what's going exclusively talk about what's going on that's wrong, there's a lot of a reclamation of history that's been lost and victories for people of like people of color, and also people of, you know, different genders and sexualities that have traditionally not been represented. So it's really important to like have that parallel, something to fill the gap with, instead of just focusing on like, well, here's how we've been given the short end of the stick or whatever. It's like, well, here's how, despite being given the short end of the stick, certain cultural beliefs and practices that are beautiful and have really beautiful origins have been preserved over time. So I really appreciate that approach more so than like the divisiveness of terms like race traitor. So I think that I had posted that just after having an experience of posting a song that has multicultural roots. And so it's got influence of like Northumbrian English, but it's also got West African traditional folk music intertwined into it. And the history of this song, it's complex. And if you do a little bit of research, you'll see that nobody agrees on the specific origins of the song. Some people claim it's English. Some people claim it's Irish. Some people claim that it's African in origin. And it's funny because if you listen to the patterns of the song, if you're a musician, you become accustomed to sort of recognizing patterns, intervals and whatnot that are more common in certain cultures. There tend to be some cultural musical habits that you can come to recognize. It's got elements of all three of those. And I sort of have my hypothesis that it's a combination of them, because if you think about it, those cultural groups interacted a lot during sort of like colonization and the slave trade. There was a lot of cross-pollination, so to speak. And this one person was like, this song has Black origins. Why don't you want to admit that to yourself? Sort of like implying that I had like a self-hating thing going on and that I was in denial about the truth. And I was like really super fed up with that. I was just like, I want to be able to acknowledge my sort of African lineage without being limited to it, without being reduced to it, because it's not the only thing that informs my experience. It is one very important part of my experience, but I need to contextualize that with like the fact, like a lot of things, like the fact that I grew up in New York, which is incredibly diverse. I've been in circles where there are predominantly white males, and that's been a lot of my sort of socialization. So, and then I've also been in spaces that are predominantly African-American people, I've been in spaces that are predominantly Hispanic people. I've been in all sorts of different spaces. And who
and that
I
was am. Just one walk yeah. down a couple of blocks of New York, right?
Yeah. Have you ever taken the train all the way from Manhattan, like lower Manhattan to the Bronx? You get.
I actually like, have.
Yeah. You've yeah. essentially visited five different countries if you've done that in an hour and a half.
I actually had.
Yeah.
Do you know what? That was my first ever proper racial experience because yeah. I was a fresh-faced 19-year-old who'd grown up in Europe and traveled around Europe and Australia and felt he was pretty multicultural. Mm-hmm. But it's a whole different thing in the States, the charged history. It makes sense. But yeah. I went to the Bronx Zoo during the day and I'd stolen my brother's leather jacket for the trip, which was super, super cool jacket. I felt really like it was kind of cool, fancy looking thing. So, you know, I kind of stood out in this like showy piece. And the Bronx Zoo is beautiful. It's really awesome. I went there in the day. And I got completely lost leaving the zoo to get to the train station to head back into Manhattan. Uh-huh. And it got dark. And I was walking around and suddenly I felt this sense of not fitting in. And I'd never felt it before. And it was a really interesting feeling. And then I watched fear creep in. And I guess there was definitely some menace in the air. I wasn't imagining all of it. There was some pretty yeah. weird looks of like, because I was yeah. very much touristy, like yeah. young white dude. Like, what are you doing here? Yeah. I wasn't street savvy.
Yeah.
And yet then I also watched fear kick in and what was clearly unconscious biases I have as well. As I'm sitting in the train station, there was just a whole lot of Black American faces and me, and I felt really different and I felt quite scared and I felt quite vulnerable. And I watched as each station, as I got closer in, it kind of mixed a little bit more. Mm. Yeah. And I guess I just kind of got rudely initiated into the fact of, yeah, black and white is a thing still, even though you've been largely kind of protected from it, from the kind of experience that I've been having my life. And yeah, it was quite intense, but yeah. also.
Wow. That is yeah. like a really powerful and vulnerable thing to share too, because you're kind of admitting to this racial experience that you have that was highly charged that you didn't expect to have. And you're kind of confronted with like, oh, okay. Now I'm having to sort of look at my interpretation of this experience. And I didn't have an opportunity to do that before and didn't realize that that would, you know, you're not going to be that person that thinks that way. And then when you do, you're like, and I've had this experience too with people of my own race and with people of other races. I've watched myself create narratives about people yeah. just based on how they look. I've watched myself look at and you think that white people are exempt from it too when you buy into the mainstream narrative of what racism is and whatnot. But when you think about like, if I am in the Upper West Side and I see older white guys, that what that brings up for me is stuff that I don't think I consciously believe. A lot comes up in that experience. The same as
what's the Upper West Side white guy experience? Is that well, what stereotype? I mean,
just like rich asshole. I don't know.
Rich, right? Yeah. yeah.
Like rich boomer.
Is it quite Jewish in that area as well?
Sure. Actually, I never thought like looked into the history of that area, but I do know that like.
But that's where a lot of money is, a lot yeah, of like elitism and kind of pretentious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I start to construct these narratives that they're looking down on me, that they think I'm a heathen and that they think I'm a whore. And it's really just, it's me, things that I think about myself in that context that I'm projecting onto those people that they might very well think about me, but the fact that I'm like, it's so charged because a lot of them are probably like, when you think about it, a lot of them probably are thinking those things about me because I'm an outsider. I don't belong to that community. I'm not what I'm. And this sort of fear, tribalist fear that we have is always going
to come up. It's delicate to poke at that.
Yeah, it's going to come up. And knowing that that's a universal experience and pretending when we pretend we're not experiencing that, we are incentivized to justify it, which is more dangerous because that's how you get actual blatant violent racism. That's how you get actual blatant violent misogyny, when you pretend that there shouldn't be any kind of difference between male, female, or intersex people, you know? And it's like, yeah, there are things beyond the binary, but people who are having a binary experience need to be honest about the fact that they're having a binary experience, and how that informs the way they move through the world and are seen in the world is just as valid as someone who's having a non-binary experience with gender, or somebody who's having an African-American or African experience is going to have a different experience, and that they're carrying a lot of unconscious cultural narratives, some of which are very positive and some of which are very negative. And like, we all kind of need the freedom to have that complexity. And we tend to just reduce each other to what feels safe, you know?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. But isn't it, it's not often that we can talk about or identify our over-exaggerations, perhaps. Like, it's almost a bit taboo because it's, you know, we have a bit of shame around it. Like, you know, I feel a little more comfortable telling that story because I was 19. That was 16 years ago.
Yeah.
So, like, I like to think I'd be a bit more, you know, hip and savvy now and a bit more, like, cool. But I felt like suddenly my life was in danger because I'm lost in the Bronx after dark because I'd watched all these movies, you know, like The Warriors and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I'd have to fight my way through the Bronx or something like that. And it's, I feel like a little embarrassed about that. But what that shows is just how heightened my experience of these racial stories is. And what you're talking about of like, you know, because it's kind of projecting to some degree, isn't it? It's
absolutely.
Like, I'm being judged by like white dudes, but most of them are probably just trying to get where they're going and they probably don't give a shit about you, but not completely.
Yeah.
And my partner's experience here, she's from Southeast Asia and we're in Australia, super heightened experience to going around to this really kind of white upper middle class supermarket area where, you know, people are pretty like that. I wouldn't be surprised, but from my perspective, her dials turned up like massively where it's like, that's all she feels she's being seen as. And it's kind of that we've internalized things and we create our own kind of exaggerated hells and prisons out of that, which is, it's difficult to talk about because to admit that you've got to show that you're kind of owned by these narratives that we'd like to think of ourselves as above.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of the sort of my desire to help people create a healthy self-mythology sort of comes out of the awareness that, if you are not in control of your own mythology, external mythologies are dictating your experience. And so you have this, you know, The Warriors, and it basically fed your experience to you. And then you replicated that experience when you had it in reality. But it wasn't necessarily like it became your experience through someone else telling their story. And it hijacked your story. Your story became that story, regardless of whether or not it was empirically true. Were you actually in danger? Honestly, people were probably just like, look at this asshole with his fancy jacket. He doesn't belong here. We're going to make him feel like he doesn't belong here because we have a cultural narrative, and I'm just surfacing here, but we have a cultural narrative that people like that judge us and are the reason why we might not be able to experience certain things we want to experience. And so,
I'm having this stereotypical, I just want to fit in, man. I like everything cool that I've loved kind of originated from those parts of New York. And more than anything, I just want to be loved and accepted. So like, how do we, this comes back to the beginning of what we're talking about, of what I feel that arcane intellect represents, which is a similar process I'm going through of, all right, so we've been through all these different identity stories. We've looked at gender. We've looked at race. We've inhabited different subcultures. I think I saw you went through or still embody like a goth persona. And there's all these different things that we've been through.
Once an emo, always an emo.
Yeah. And then how do we make sense of that on the other side? So it sounds like you and I have both gone through this process of deconstructing as much of that as possible, of trying to balance the rational and the mythic. And I mean, how do you end up not just like some vacuum, some void, some kind of like empty of everything, which in some ways is maybe a really spiritual place to end up. But in other ways, I'm wanting to now create in that kind of transrational space a new mythic persona for myself.
Yeah.
And this for me is what the philosophy of metamodernism really speaks to, of like reclaiming that and reclaiming that personal grand narrative and mythologizing myself in a way that doesn't turn into a kind of narcissistic ego story, but really vivifies my existence. I recognize that for a long period of time, I just became invisible, because it's easier to just watch other people's worldviews and kind of see this is a clusterfuck of everyone fighting from their different perspectives. The last thing that's needed is another voice in the fray. But now I've reached a point where it's like, no, I want to exist. I want to reclaim the numinous in my life, and I want to like boldly proclaim the magic that I see. But that's a really delicate thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we kind of need each other to do that with. We kind of need to play off each other with that and see each other in that way. And that's where community is kind of important for me. So
yeah.
I wonder if that speaks to you and where you are in your kind of emergence again on the other side of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deconstruction.
Yeah, you're really speaking to what the Arcane Intellect Project is about when you say that.
Mm.
It's about reclaiming narrative, mythology, hope, naivety, and sort of ineffability in a way where it's actually grounded in reality rather than an escape from reality. Because I feel like the sort of modernist progress is trying to escape from a harsh world, trying to progress for the sake of just not being in a world that you see as shitty and against you, and nature wants to kill you and all of that, like that stuff that modernism kind of comes from is this belief that, that nature is vicious and cruel, and that we have to create a world that isn't that. We have to escape that world into a transcendent world. And a lot of the past value systems have been about trying to leave a certain world behind in order to seek a better world. And I think that we can reconcile that desire that we have to create a better world. And this is where metamodernity speaks to me, is because it's about recognizing the here and now, and recognizing both what's there and what's not there, and at the same time, rather than just focusing on what's not there and trying to make it happen. I think that's sort of unique to it. I could be wrong, but that's something that I sense there. And I think that the concept of magic is really just, the idea of magic is really just a metaphor for that which cannot be explained yet, but that which you know is real and true. And I think that being able to tentatively label something before you understand it is a really crucial, necessary process for understanding it. And we're kind of, I think that the metamodern community and even the integral community and meta theorists in general are kind of like martyrs, weirdly martyrs. Like, if I'm going to mythologize, you know, I may as well go for it, in the sense that, like, well, you have to really embrace foolishness. Like, you have to embrace this sort of flailing in the dark experience, and not only embrace it, but incentivize it and make it seem cool so that more people want to do it, so that we can actually, maybe future generations will start to get some semblance of how to construct this world. If, you know, we might even run out of time before we get there. But yeah, the simultaneous hope and hopelessness that's kind of here today is, I think, really the core of why magic is being called back from the cobwebs of the past, so to speak.
Do you ever have the black cat of nihilism crawl in, jump in through your window and come and curl up close to you? Because it's something that when I brought a more rational kind of mindset online about 5 or 6 years ago and really drilled down into that way of being, I find there's this kind of void that I have an access to now that in some ways I'm really grateful for, because I'm like, this is what all the German philosophers were talking about. But in other ways, I'm kind of like, it's like, it's a lot. And I wonder whether you ever touched with that sensation. Oh.
I would say maybe like 75% of my existence is the void. And I'm not saying that to be cool. Part of the reason why I have this, I have an intentionally performative goth persona. And it's like, it's almost like an ironically sincere representation of that sort of void space. Like, I'm really quite sensitive and I would like to think of myself as rather kind, even if I might not express it in like the most traditionally kind way. Like my intentions are typically good, even if my intentions are dark, they're still coming from a place of like, I want things to change in a positive way, if that makes sense. So I'm essentially an NLP practitioner. That's part of what I do with ritual art. I combine it with tarot. And in NLP, you have these sort of useful untruths, to steal a phrase from Kurt Vonnegut, or harmless untruths, where they're called presuppositions. And one of the presuppositions is that every behavior has a positive intention. So what you're really trying to do when you like do something hurtful, or you say something mean, or you forget to show up on time for a thing, is you're not actually trying to hurt a person. Or if you are trying to hurt a person, it's because you're actually trying to get a positive outcome in maybe an unsophisticated way. So when I say that my intentions are usually good, that's what I mean. I don't mean my behavior is always good. just to clarify. So I have this intentionally performative goth emo persona because it represents that sort of like trying to reclaim this darkness that just looms everywhere that we've been trained to ignore. And I think that we have seen that perhaps this is just like a shot in the dark here, but perhaps we're seeing a mental health crisis and a rise in depression and anxiety because we have not effectively equipped people to deal with negative emotions, which are a inevitable aspect of the human experience. We're told that if we feel sad, something's wrong. Sometimes I just feel sad, and sometimes I want to feel sad. Sometimes I want to feel hopeless. I want to feel what that feels like. I want to notice what I notice when I'm in that state. I want to really, really get to the core of what that state is designed for. Why do we have access to that kind of experience in the first place? You know, why do our brains release those chemicals? Why does our physiology contract when those chemicals are released? Why is it incredibly difficult to get out of bed on those days? I'm curious about it. I value it. And I think that it's really important to reclaim that, to reclaim the negative feeling states that are essentially 50% of our experience on this planet, you know, because we've exalted this escapism into positivity. We've exalted this escapism into bliss. Overvalued happiness. We're like, oh, happiness is what we want. Is it though? Is it really? I don't really want to be happy all the time. I enjoy rage. I enjoy sadness, and I enjoy confusion. I can find pleasure in many states that are considered negative states. Not all of them. Obviously, there are still some that I have resistances to, but there's an alchemical process that comes from inviting these states in a neutral way rather than having a preference for some of them, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. It strikes me that a really generative practice might be applying ritual art to the void. It's this kind of unspoken place and experience that is all too common in the modern world, but is difficult to approach or talk about. And I think it's that's inspiring me, is something that I might explore and really delve into. So thank you, Scout, for spending this time with me and giving me a little peek into the wonderfully rich and fertile worlds that are your imagination and psyche. It's it's been really beautiful to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been great. And I really look forward to engaging with you more and reading your content and everything. And I'm super honored that you wanted to speak with me today.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. Show notes are available online at www.joelightfoot.org, where you can also find more information about my book, A Collective Blooming. Music by Johnny Eagle. Until next time, be well, my friends.